All I know is that before Bush met with Gorbachev, remember the body language, remember how he looked. Someday when we do another version of this tape, I'm going to try to pull together all the video of both of those gentlemen before the MALVA meeting, and then video after, and then video at the Helsinki conference, and then video up to the present. There's some interesting dynamic that is not coming across in the words, but it's coming across in the music, and the music is the body language, and the camera, as Dan Rather says, never blinks, and the camera has recorded an undercurrent here that we're not tracking, that we're not privy to. But when you ask yourself, when you look at the world and see the stunning changes, what's the one thing big enough to have affected a radical turn in history in a short period of time? The only thing that makes sense is something having to do with the cosmos, our presence vis-a-vis other folks out there, learning data that we now, you know, have a pretty good handle on. And then, of course, you have Ronald Reagan, who said five times, if we were ever confronted with a power from outer space that presented a threat, we would get together as one human family. Well, with the exception of Saddam Hussein, that curve is tracking pretty well, is it not?
Richard, one last question, if I may. What are your feelings about the Philadelphia experiments?
Well, someone asked me this a couple days ago, and I said that if you'd asked me that question 6 months ago, I would have said, you know, it's a nice fairy tale, and let's go on the real stuff. Having gotten more and more deeply into the physics implications of the Sedonia equations and the potential hyperdimensional technologies, I mean, look, let's hit the nail on the head. We are talking about other dimensions. That's what these physics all reduce to. If I can prove in a set of equations that another dimension is a physical reality, and the three dimensions are a projection of four dimensions or five or six, then I can well believe that the military, with vast infinite resources, impelled by the terror of Hitler and Tojo in World War II, in experimenting around with some stuff that maybe they had taken from Tesla and others, inadvertently tripped over hyperdimensional physics, and it scared the bejesus out of them. I can well believe that, but I don't see it as a coherent, careful experiment that was planned and they knew what they were doing. It's like kids playing with H-bombs or, you know, the kids playing with matches. I think this stuff, in some aspects, has repercussions, the likes of which we would not want to see loosed without careful forethought. And I think that the Philadelphia experiment, if it came off as we have heard about it through many sources now, may have been an example of being at the wrong place at the right time with some very bizarre things happening because people didn't really understand what they were playing with.
All right.
Richard Hoagland is with us. He is our science advisor, and we talk about a lot of interesting stuff. Richard, continue if you would, and also we have your guest standing by.
Well, I wanted to take a moment here to bring people's attention to something which appeared in this month's issue of Air and Space Magazine, which is kind of strange. Okay. I mean, it's positive and it's negative simultaneously. And how many times can you say that, Chuck, in the same sentence? Air and Space is a magazine published by the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum.
Yes.
And in this month's issue, there is a column, in fact, there's a whole article, full page, written by Alex Hurd, titled Face Off, which, as you might suspect, contains information and a kind of a back and forth on our research over the last several years. What's intriguing about it is what it says about you, Chuck. And what it says, what it does not say about our research and some of the political shenanigans that have been going on around it. Let me get to the part about you.
Yes.
I thought you might be intrigued about this. Hoagland and Chuck Harder, the show's host, get pretty imaginative. After cancellation of Hoagland's Mars, Harder said, I do believe one of the reasons Hoagland's Mars has been put on ice has got to do with this Mideast thing. Once your program would be transmitted, the press would jump on it, and it might steal some of Bush's thunder from his project.
And then it says, Hoagland replies, well, it's even more disturbing than that. And we talk about the energy business. What they say in introducing you, Chuck, is they say that I've been flagging this miracle device, the N-Space Technologies, on For the People, an overheated radio talk show in Cedar Key, Florida. A couple of items that I wanted to comment on about that. One is, it's not in Cedar Key, it's in Bright Springs.
Well,
two,
okay.
It's not a radio show, it's a network.
Yeah.
And three, who overheated this discussion in the first place? When George Bush calls someone on the contemporary political scene a Hitler, doesn't that kind of raise the level of drama to a whole new height? And after that, how could you and I possibly be overheated?
Well, all I know is they got the name right. That was good. Did they spell the name right?
Yes.
Okay. They spell my name right?
Yes.
They get For the People correct?
I believe, yes, it is, yes.
Well, thank them.
The other thing, which is more substantive, is they talk about how we wrote to Robert Rowe, chairman of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology in 89.
Now, who are they again?
Is an article in Air and Space magazine,
yeah.
This month's issue, published by the Smithsonian. Article written by Alex Hurd, who is one of their stable writers.
Oh, what, no, so Alex Hurd is the one who is doing all of this rhetoric, right?
Yes, this is Alex Hurd's piece.
Why don't we get him on the phone?
I imagine at some point it might be a nice idea.
Yeah, say, Alex, we'd like to welcome you to our overheated international radio show.
Well, here's the substantive part. Alex talks about the political problems that we have had, that I have said that we have had, vis-a-vis NASA, in simply getting simple verification of some scientific measurements. What's the big deal, right?
Yes.
And he cites in a letter that I wrote in 89 to Robert Rowe, quote, political obstacles within NASA have blocked serious consideration of this evidence for 13 years.
That's true.
Well, it is true.
Yes.
He then goes on to say the latest alleged outrage involves the cancellation of a documentary called Hoagland Flies that was produced by NASA's Lewis Research Center in Cleveland, Ohio. Well, the problem I have is twofold. One is it isn't alleged. It's public common knowledge admitted to by the agency itself, and now they've retracted it and are putting something together called Hoagland's Mars to be broadcast this summer. That's the first thing.
Well, why don't we tell them this?
The second thing, which is really most important, it isn't that we just wrote to Bob Rowe.
Yeah.
It's been 3 days. He had us down for a meeting with many of the other investigators, serious scientists who've been involved in this. He took 6 months to consider what needed to be done.
Uh-huh.
He went to NASA and said, you will take the pictures of Siponia in 1993. And then, most interesting, he said on the record in major national newspapers and radio shows and TV interviews, like the Wall Street Journal, that he had seen the photographs, he had seen the study. There did appear to be a pyramid and face objects on the Martian surface that did not appear to be of natural origin, and it looked like they had to be of intelligent design.
Yeah.
And the fact that Mr. Hurd neglected to drop the other shoe is a bit like, to me, describing a crash of a 757 and neglecting to tell anybody that all 300 people walked away without a scratch.
Well, why don't you help him to mend his errant ways by sending him photocopies of these different clips and what have you.
Well, we intend to do that, but I think it would also be important, considering this is a political constituency issue now. If NASA is going to be held to the fire and held accountable, it's going to be because the political process works and American citizens desire those photographs be taken. I would suggest a line or two dropped by people to the Smithsonian, to Air and Space Magazine at 900 Jefferson Davis Drive.
Wait a minute, let's go for a piece of paper and a pen. All right, piece of paper and pen, everybody.
Okay, I'm sorry, the editorial offices are at 370 L'Enfant Promenade.
Oh, come on.
Yes, 370 L'Enfant.
Isn't it L'apostrophe?
L'apostrophe.
L'apostrophe, E-N-F-A-N-T, meaning little child in French.
Yep, Enfant Promenade, Southwest, 10th floor, Washington, D.C., 20024. And the editor, of course, gently correct the record, because when a major committee chairman says there look to be intelligent artifacts on Mars, the story that they published does not include that. I, as a journalist, would say that was an incomplete story, wouldn't you?
Well, there's a lot of that in the water nowadays.
Well, we should not let people be sloppy if we can help it.
Let's correct them. Let's help them. All right, Richard.
Richard, you were watching, obviously, the program today, which was called A Closer Look. It was a daytime television news magazine. Pat Daniels was the anchor, quote-unquote. and I also tape-recorded it. I was able to wade through the commercials. There was very little time for the last of the half hour with commercials. Would you not have agreed?
Yeah. I thought that a balanced presentation, and even Daniels herself was first to admit during one segment, you guys really have a good taste.
Yeah.
So if you could read between the lines and work past the fluttering eyelashes and be, oh, you can't possibly believe this. You're sane, sober, serious people. You can't really believe this stuff. You got the gist that maybe, just maybe, there was fire.
Yeah.
Which was a first for network television news presentation on this subject.
Well, I think that the CBS TV Visitors from the Unknown was very, very well done.
But you see, that was not done by the news division.
Correct.
That was done by the entertainment division and is viewed by those in the know in media, people like Tom Cales of the Washington Post, as, well, that's just entertainment. The Chase Daniel thing, her notwithstanding, is a news production of NBC News. And that means that we have to look at it from the media lens perspective differently than the production on CBS a couple, 3 weeks ago.
So, what are you saying?
I'm saying that there is a strong demand here. There is some reason why NBC News has decided to make this an issue and to devote an entire program. Because normally, in television, particularly these daytime shows, where, again, you don't want to get too serious, you don't devote an entire half hour, chopped up as it is with commercials, to one subject. That is taboo. They will switch the dial. They will not buy your product. So you break it up with three or four light segments, light features, whatever. To devote the entire half hour to this one subject was another criteria that somebody somewhere in NBC thinks this is a very interesting story. And how they put it on the air in their time slot today.
Now, could that be the first little, let's raise the flag and see who salutes type of thing? In other words, now let's take a look at the media here. General Electric owns NBC. We are sure that on the editorial board of NBC News, there has to be somebody from corporate around when they have their roundtable discussions talking about the stuff they're going to put on the air. So here we have maybe a trial balloon. Let's faith handle this thing during daytime TV. If we catch too much adverse flack, we can always say, hey, nobody was watching daytime TV. If it works out well, let's do a special.
Or we move it to Tom Brokaw on Exposé or the Evening News. I think you're absolutely right, Chuck. I think your instincts are right on this one, and I think that's exactly what we saw this afternoon.
Well, the outcome, of course, is at the heart of the question that Daniels asked Friedman, which is, why would the government lie? Why would they not want the American people to know if extraterrestrial spacecraft were zipping around the Earth or had crashed back in 1947? And I thought Friedman, who was a nuclear physicist who has been on this trail for 30 years, had a very cogent response. He said three reasons. One is technology. If this crash did occur, and our guys picked up debris and engine parts and other things, in the mindset of the world, circa 1947, after the most horrific world war in the history of this planet, no one in the military was going to possibly let anybody outside know that they had picked up something this sensitive, this interesting, this potentially valuable technically, because we were then getting into an imbroglio with the Russians, you know, for control of the planet. And we, of course, would not want them to know that we had this, even if we had it. So
There were several and the final reason was that there may be something political destabilizing by even the knowledge that we were not alone, because, as he said rather eloquently, there's a new generation now that if the government were to come out and admit tomorrow the human race is not the only guys on the block, that we have company and neighbors, then there'd be a lot of people who would suddenly see themselves not as United States citizens or Soviet citizens or Dominion citizens, but as Earth citizens, citizens of the planet. And at that point, St. Daniels kind of cut him off with a laugh and a giggle and didn't let him finish it, which was to say, there isn't a government on this planet that wants its citizens to use to anybody except them. Well, the thought that I wanted to leave this segment with is that this is why the Mars mission and the Mars research is critically important. I've known Stan Friedman now, you know, maybe 10 years, and I've followed his activities on the political and the legal front, trying to unearth with superhuman Herculean efforts through the legal process, the FOIA Act and all that. Reinforcements, you know, from the NSA and the CIA and other archives of the government. And what he gets and shows on television is a page full of blanked out stuff, where on the whole page there are 5 to 8 words you can read, and of course you can't hear anything from 5 or 8 words. Our approach is very different. As people know who have listened to this program over the last year or so, we have what we believe are profound mathematical and geometric clues on a set of photographs taken by NASA on a planet called Mars, on a northern desert region called Cydonia, with a whole extraterrestrial set of ruins, the civilization right next door, and the CIA cannot hide a whole planet. They can't black it out. So when that mission, that NASA mission in 1993, goes back and takes the pictures per the mandate of the chairman of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, with whom we have, you know, briefed and been in touch with and communicated with, and on behalf of the whole committee,
yeah,
the American people will finally know, without any obfuscation, that's hiding, what is in terms of extraterrestrial presence in our neighborhood right next door, and then what we have to do about it. But that is not going to happen unless there is a educated, untapped constituency that holds their feet to the fire and makes sure that those photographs aren't blacked out like Friedman's documents. So the only way that they can do that,
yeah,
is if For the People and the Mars mission cooperate, and through our combined constituencies, we provide information to people, and we provide a mechanism to translate the people's interest back to Washington, so that in 1992, which is an election year, our congressmen and senators, the last bastion of democracy, I believe, in this republic, feel the heat. They feel that somebody gives a damn, and they think this is important, and they are not going to sit and take it anymore.
Don't forget that they're telling us that they're going to turn SETI, S-E-T-I, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. We are told that they're going to turn the SETI network on in 1992. In other words, for some reason, although the giant dishes are already there and pointing to the sky, we're not going to turn them on until next year.
How come? I think it's more political timing. I think that there may be, and I'm hoping there is, some kind of a timetable behind the scenes, and that someone has decided that it is only an inevitable amount of time before this all comes out. And they're trying to get ahead of the curve. They're trying to do the things to prepare the population, to prepare the culture, to prepare the American people to the fact that, yeah, guys, we're not alone, and we know a great deal of information, and this is what it's going to mean in the years to come.
All right.
I hope...